how does plantation society in Hawaii differ from other plantation societies?
Well, in Hawaii, you had a diversity of workers from all over the world, not just Asia, particularly China, then Japan, the Philippines, Korea. On other plantations, say in the West Indies, you don't have that kind of diversity. So that makes Hawaii unique in terms of plantation societies. And that was the basis of Hawaii becoming such a multicultural society.
Are there any other ways that they're different?
Well, I think that in Hawaii, because of the crisscrossing of paths of workers from all around the world, you find them living together. You also find a sharing of cultures. They shared their holidays, like Rizal Day, the Obon Festival, Chinese New Year. They even had a Christmas tree there with the German immigrants working in Hawaii. And I think that made Hawaii a uniquely multicultural society. What else about Hawaii that would be unique? I think in Hawaii, you had strikes that crossed ethnic lines. I'm thinking about the 1920 strike, where Filipino and Japanese workers went out on strike together. They began as separate unions, the Japanese Laborers Association and the Filipino Laborers Association, but then they came together in unity and strike. And in the action of the strike, they gave themselves a new name for their union, the Hawaii Laborers Association. So they had reinvented themselves. They were no longer just Japanese and Filipinos, but now there are Hawaiian workers. And that makes Hawaii unique.
Okay. I'm going to have to
It's warm in here with the sun coming through.
You kind of, and you know, some of these questions you may find repetitive.
That's all right.
But it's also, you know, the way that we phrase the question solicits a certain kind of answer. Yeah. So can you describe the multi-ethnicity of the plantation camps? Like, how do the ethnicities interact, especially when they lived separately?
Well, the plantation setup was like a pyramid. You had the plantation master's home on the top of the mountain, and then you had the Portuguese lunas and their cabins, and then you had the Japanese workers, and below the Japanese workers you have the Filipino camps. And that pyramid emblematized the hierarchical structure of the plantation. Hawaii's diversity didn't just happen. It was diversity by design. The planters wanted to bring in workers from all over the world in order to pit them against each other, especially workers from Asia. And so the camps represented this coming of different workers from different countries. And so first you had the Chinese camp, and then the Japanese camp, and then the Filipino camp. But the separation of the camps also reinforced this separation of workers from different nations and the pitting of these workers against each other. I've done research in the archives of the Hawaii Planters Association, And I've come across memos where planters stated explicitly that they wanted to bring in so many Japanese and so many Filipinos in order to pit them against each other and drive wages downward. In fact, the Japanese initially represented the, well, not initially, initially the Chinese, first initially the Hawaiians and then the Chinese. But then after the Chinese Exclusion Act, Hawaii turned, when Hawaii became part of the United States, turned to Japan for its labor supply. And by 1905, Japanese workers represented 70% of the entire plantation workforce. And in 1909, they went out on strike. And it was an all-Japanese strike. And this strike was fueled by Japanese nationalism. They saw themselves as Japanese. And at that time, we had what was called blood unionism. In order to belong to the union, you had to be Japanese. You had to have Japanese blood. The planters broke that strike. And then they looked elsewhere for another source of labor. And they turned to the Philippines. Asian labor had been restricted because of, one, the Chinese Exclusion Act and then the Gentlemen's Agreement of 1907. But the Philippines had become a territory of the United States, so there was access to Filipino labor. And so after the 1909 strike, planters brought in waves of Filipino workers, so that by 1920, Filipinos constituted 30% of the workforce and Japanese 40%. And so the planters had an ideal workforce from their point of view, where they could pit workers of different nationalities, in this case Filipinos and Japanese, against each other. Let's
That's my dog.
Honey?
Well, you know, given that given that in the case after 1909, the Filipinos were specifically brought in to diversify the workforce, the Japanese must have recognized how that would dilute their power. So what was the Japanese response to this new wave of a different ethnic immigrant?
Well, the initial response was competition with the Filipino workers. But I think something else had happened within the Japanese plantation community. For one thing, they were having children by 1920. And many of them were thinking about staying in Hawaii now because they had children born in Hawaii and Hawaii had become their home. And so they had to rethink their relationship to the land and also then to their competition, the Filipinos. And I think this opened the way then for them to unite with the Filipinos in common struggle. Not only were they having children in Hawaii, they also were becoming American. I saw a photograph of plantation workers on strike, and they were having a mass demonstration in Ala Park in downtown Honolulu. It was a huge, massive demonstration. It was just a sea of faces. But with this crowd, you also saw the American flag. You saw many American flags. They saw themselves as Americans now. And you saw children who were American citizens by birth, even though their parents could not become citizens because citizenship was reserved for whites only. But what stood out for me was also a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. They knew about Lincoln as the great emancipator, and Lincoln, who had given the famous Gettysburg Address. Maybe they themselves hadn't heard the Gettysburg Address, but their children had, their children in school. And they realized that this country was founded, dedicated, to use Lincoln's language, to the proposition that all men are created equal. And so when they went out on strike in 1920, joining with the Filipinos, they were saying, we're Americans too, and we should have decent wages because this is now our home,
I know that you're a very animated speaker, but sometimes I can pick up like the sounds. So if you can try to not basically patting your
hands.
That's the loudest one that I'm getting.
Oh, okay. Do you want to sit on the bench there?
Oh no, this is fine.
No matter
where you sit, you're gonna use your hands.
This is you know, I have a Hawaiian style of talking. You know, you talk with your hands. Yeah.
You can talk with them in the air.
Yeah, okay.
So now, you've described the ethnic separations of the camps, but when did the different ethnicities work together? Were they integrated in the fields? How did that crossover happen?
They were separated, but they were also integrated. They worked in integrated gangs, not only with Filipinos, but with Koreans and Chinese and some Hawaiians. And this is why you have the emergence of a common language, Pidgin English, so that the managers could bark out commands in English to a multilingual workforce, and the workforce would be able to understand them. So not all of the gangs were segregated. Many of them were integrated gangs.
And then how did, you know, you talked about different holidays being shared and stuff. So did they take that integration on the workplace back home, or how did that happen?
Yeah, even though the camps were separated, they came together for the Obon festivals, for example. It wasn't just Japanese at these festivals. And with Rizal Day, the Japanese workers knew about Rizal Day too. So festivals and holidays were an important moment of sharing different cultures and different ethnicities. And so in the camps, these workers were reinventing themselves. You know, ethnicity is not something that is static. You're not just Japanese or just Filipino. In the interaction with other Asian Americans, you become Asian American. And I think that's what was happening to Japanese, Filipino, Korean, and Chinese workers on the plantations of Hawaii.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by they were inventing themselves?
They were, I think reinventing themselves. Well, at first, the Japanese thought of themselves as Japanese. And then when they had children here, they were saying, wait a minute, I'm not just Japanese now. I'm developing roots in Hawaii. And Hawaii is part of the United States. I'm an American. And then through the sharing of their holidays and the development of a common language, they said, oh, I'm also a worker. That's important. I'm not a Japanese worker. I'm a worker in Hawaii. And so you have this reinvention process going on in the thinking of Japanese immigrants and also Filipino immigrants too. With Filipino immigrants to Hawaii, I think they brought with them a consciousness that they were already Americans because they came from a territory of the United States. But in Hawaii, they also began to realize that as Americans, they were still discriminated against. They were distinctive because of the color of their skin. And they were also workers, exploited workers. So Filipinos began to develop a class consciousness in Hawaii, which they did not have in the Philippines.
Can you talk about how the workers transformed their camps into communities?
Oh, yes. At first, the camps were like clusters of shabby buildings, shabby cabins. But then they began to give their homes a feeling of the old country. The Japanese, for example, would build furos and they would put bonsais around their cabins. And they began to see Hawaii as their home, a permanent settlement. And so also they began to set up stores in the plantations, and these were Japanese-owned stores, and they began to supply foods to themselves. And so Hawaii became like little Japan towns on the plantations.
Can you describe some of those living conditions from early on, and then how they evolved and why they evolved?
Well, first I said they were dilapidated and they were slum-like. But then the planters felt pressures from the workers to improve the living conditions on the in the camps because of the strikes, for example. And so the planters were making concessions, but they thought that it would help to control that workforce, to improve the camp and living conditions, so that workers would not be as dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm. How bad were the worst of the camps, and how good were the better camps?
Well, the camps became better, especially after the 1909 strike and the 1920 strike. In the beginning, they didn't even have running water, for example. I think by the 1920s, the camps had running water. Better cabins were built in the 1920s. So I would say that by the 1920s, you had pretty good camps. But then, even there, it varies from plantation to plantation. It depends upon who was the plantation manager.
And can you talk about different kinds of control that the plantations had over the workers, like within their workday, but then also in their home life as well?
Well, for the workday, the planters used the clock as a way to discipline and punish and control the workforce. At 5 a.m., there was a plantation siren that blasted the workers and woke them up. And this was a way of using the clock as a way to get your workforce to work. And then at 4 o'clock, there would be another siren, and that would be the message that workers were finished working, that was pauhana time, finished working. So the clock was one method. Another method of disciplining and punishing the workforce was to pit workers of different nationalities against each other, and to say, you know, who can outperform, you know, who can cut more cane. A third method was to assign workers a certain portion of the field, and then to contract with these workers, saying, you have to cultivate and harvest this field within 3 months. So the workers had to do it within that period of time, or else get docked on their pay. Another method was to promote the migration of women, especially from Japan. I came across memos from plantation managers saying, we need more Japanese women, because these Japanese were contract laborers. They were assigned to a certain plantation for a specific number of years. And you have Japanese workers running away, breaking the contract. And so the planters thought, well, one way to reduce this impulse to run away is to tie the workers down with wives and children. And so you have now the planters systematically bringing more women over. And after the gentleman's agreement, they promoted the picture bride system. So that was another way to control the workforce, to make them workers with families.
And then what about in their off-work hours? How did the plantations stay present in their lives?
Well, in the off-work hours, especially after the strikes of 1909 and 1920, the planters set up recreational facilities like baseball fields. And that was, again, designed to control this workforce, to make them a happier workforce, so that they would be playing baseball rather than organizing strikes. But I think the planters exercised what can be called paternalism. That was their method of controlling their workers, by having a paternalistic overview and control over their workers.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, paternalism means you're parental. Okay, so these are the parents who are like taking care of their children. And so, but what this does is that it tries to keep the workforce adolescent.
And what does that reflect about the planter's view of their workers?
It represents a business view of their workers. Paternalism is good business. But also it represents a racial hierarchy, you know, white over Asian workers. So it's part of a world view, you know, of America as white and then workers of color then as children.
And you had mentioned other forms of control over the workers' lives prior to paternalism, like if paternalism was like the carrot. You had mentioned in Palhana forms of control that were more like a stick. Can you bring those up?
Well, you had whippings, but I don't think that they were that widespread.
I'm thinking like in terms of their daily lives, like not allowing gambling or sometimes making them go to church or things like that.
Well, I don't know if they made them go to church. Church was important to the Koreans, for example. And with the Japanese, they had their Buddhist temples. But I'm not sure if the planters did set up, you know, make land available for temples and for churches. But again, that was part of paternalism, feel that this represents paternal responsibility for children.
Okay. We were talking about picture brides. Let me just go with this. Was there racial or ethnic tension between established immigrants and new arrivals?
Oh, yes, there must have been, especially since the new arrivals came from different nations. So, there were tensions between the Japanese and Koreans, for example. So they brought, you know, old world hatreds to the new world here.
How did that resolve itself?
Well, the Korean workforce was not very large, actually, because Korean workers began coming around 1903. But then immigration from Korea was stopped by 1907. Because Korea was part of Japan. And so Koreans coming over here had to come over here meaning Hawaii, with Japanese passports. And Japan simply stopped issuing passports to Koreans to go to Japan, passports to go to Hawaii, because the Japanese government wanted to protect its Japanese workers in Hawaii. But then after the gentleman's agreement, the United States cut off immigration from Japan, and that was in 1908.
I know what I was going to ask. You had talked about mm-hmm. Japanese deserters and that mm-hmm. women were sought to come in to kind of stabilize that desertion. Why would they be deserting?
Why would women be deserting?
No, why were the men deserting?
Oh, they felt that they were being exploited and being paid low wages, and they thought that they could do better, say, in Honolulu, or they could set up stores, or better, in California. So they had a 5-year contract, but they broke the contract and ran away.
Can you talk about other forms of resistance that occurred, like desertion, prior to more organized forms of resistance? How did people resist the kind of oppressive conditions they were working under?
There was what can be called day-to-day resistance. Like the 5 a.m. whistle would blast, but there were workers who didn't get up. They just stayed in bed. And there were workers who said, I'm sick today. I can't go to work today. They would fake illnesses. Workers would have slowdowns in the fields. They just wouldn't cut as much cane as the planters and their managers wanted them to do. Day-to-day resistance.
And what were the repercussions of those acts?
They could be punished, you know, docked in pay. Sometimes they were whipped. Mm-hmm. There are some funny stories about Japanese women. They were also in the fields cutting cane too. And they would hide in the cane fields and smoke, you know. Yes. So the manager wouldn't know where the women were. Huh? Yeah. So that happens today too, you know, in the workforce, where workers just take breaks without the foreman seeing them. Or they'll sit in front of their computer as if they're working, but they're playing computer games, you know? Yeah.
You talked about sports like baseball diamonds being put in, and can you talk about the competition between different camps or different plantations and also different ethnicities?
I think it was mainly different camps. I don't think they were moving from plantation to play, but I might be wrong there. But baseball became big on the plantations, especially for the Japanese workers. And when you think about it, that's part of their Americanization. They were playing an American sport, and they loved it. And this reinforced, I think, an identity of themselves as Americans. They were reinventing themselves. But that kind of reinvention would make them more discontent. Well, if we're Americans, we should be paid American wages.
Mm-hmm. And can we move to Japan now? And can you talk about some of the push factors during the Meiji Restoration period, particularly with regards for the picture brides? Like, what were conditions like for women in Meiji period Japan that would make them seek moving that far away?
Well, the Meiji Restoration was a very significant event in Japanese history. Japan was watching what was happening in China, which was being carved out by the European colonial powers, and Japan was afraid that that would happen to itself. And so with the Meiji Restoration, Japan embarked on a path of militarization and modernization. And how did Japan pay for this response? It taxed the farmers, especially. And so that created factors of push. Many of those who went to Hawaii to work as plantation workers were farmers in Japan. The Meiji Restoration also emphasized the importance of education. And this education included English. Japanese students were learning English and included history of the world, including America. And so Japanese female students were learning English and learning about the world. And they became very curious about what it must be like in the United States. And so that inspired them to think about migrating. And one way to get to Hawaii would be to become a picture bride. So there were Japanese women who became picture brides, not because they wanted to get married, but because they wanted to get to Hawaii and then to California. I think many of them were disappointed in their marriage, but nevertheless, they got to a promised land.
Well, what were people's vision impressions of Hawaii or America in Japan at that time? What do you think the women thought that they were embarking on?
Hard to say, but I think they got the propaganda, you know, that Hawaii's a paradise, it's a great place, and America is a land of great dreams and economic opportunities. For the women, Hawaii represented an opportunity for employment.
Mm-hmm. So the women in Meiji era Japan were workers.
They were workers. The Meiji economy, as it industrialized, had a workforce that was about 60% women. They were in the mines. They were in the factories. Mm-hmm.
Oh, we kind of breezed through all of these. Maybe, can you talk some, you talked about the pyramid structure, mm-hmm. and you said that that was reflected in the labor force. Can you talk about that some more in the social structure? Can you explain the role of the luna and how race was?
Yeah, the lunas were Portuguese. And then the Japanese were the workers, and Filipinos were the workers, and the managers were all white. And so you have like a hierarchy, you know, where you have the Anglo-American managers, and then the Portuguese supervisors, and then the Japanese workers. After the 1909 strike, you do find Japanese workers becoming lunas too. The structure still was one of white over non-white or Asian. Milton Murayama in his book novel, All Asking For Is My Body, has an illustration of this hierarchy. He said, on the top of the hill, you have the manager's home. Below the manager's home, you have the nicer looking homes of the Portuguese lunas, and then you have the homes of the Japanese workers, and then far in the bottom you have the shabby homes of the Filipinos. And he said you have a sewage system that runs from the manager's home all the way down to the Filipino camp and below. And he said, so you have the shit system showing this hierarchy from white to Filipino. Graphic.
you've brought up the 1909 strike several times. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the 1909 strike? And it seemed to be the first large-scale organization. So what made that possible?
I think by 1909, these Japanese immigrant workers began to understand that they were in Hawaii to stay. They were having families at this point. And so they demanded higher wages because they had families to support. But since they represented 70% of the workforce, they organized their unions around a Japanese identity. And so at their strike demonstrations, they would say, banzai, banzai, banzai. And they would salute themselves as people of Japan. But I think 1909 was also a turning point because it followed the gentlemen's agreement. There would be no further immigration from Japan. And so these workers knew that they weren't going back to Japan temporarily, because then they couldn't return to Hawaii. So that 1909 strike, I think, reflected this new consciousness that we are people of Hawaii now. But then the planters brought in the Filipinos, and so they had to think about, well, what does it mean to be members of a class? It means you unite with Filipinos, with people who are not Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I come up to more current era, are there other important things about plantation life or resistance that we should go?
We need to talk about the 1946 strike. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the 1920 strike was not successful. The planters were able to break that strike. But after they broke the strike, they introduced reforms. They did raise wages. They did improve housing conditions. In 1946, after World War II, the planters faced a different formidable opposition. This was a new union, the ILWU, that was organized by union leaders from California who went to Hawaii to organize the plantation workers. And what's amazing about the ILWU is how they made sure that it was an integrated leadership on the plantations. They practiced what would be called affirmative action. Because the Japanese still were in the leadership of the unions in Hawaii. But the ILWU said, no, you know, you can have only so many Japanese leaders, you also have to have Filipino leaders, okay? And I can remember, like, seeing some elections, you know, on plantations, where the election results would come in for the union officers, and the ILWU would say, no, too many Japanese here. You have to put in some Filipino names. But it was that kind of affirmative action that created that kind of united front that made possible the victory of the ILWU in the 1946 strike. That strike gave workers a tremendous increase in wages and gave them more respect. But it also led the plantation corporations, because they were corporations like Alexander and Castle and Cook, Alexander and Baldwin, to retreat from cane production and to invest in, to diversify their investments, so that they became international corporations with investments in Guatemala, Honduras, and Thailand. So that 1946 strike led to a tremendous economic change in Hawaii, where the sugar industry would decline and the tourist industry would rise. And the tourist industry was funded by the corporations that had their beginnings in sugar production.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Pearl Harbor. The Japanese in Hawaii had a fairly unique experience in compared to Japanese on the mainland. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The Japanese on the West Coast, the Japanese Americans on the West Coast were interned, and 120 of them were placed in concentration camps, and two-thirds of them were citizens by birth. In Hawaii, where you had a Japanese population that exceeded the Japanese population on the mainland, the Japanese Americans were not interned. And why is it that the Japanese in Hawaii were not interned? Well, there are many reasons. One is that you had a responsible media. The news media didn't behave the way the San Francisco Chronicle and the Los Angeles Times behaved, where these newspapers pictured Japanese immigrants as spies and as threats to security. In Hawaii, the newspapers there said, don't spread a rumor unless you know it's a fact. But the main reason why the Japanese Americans in Hawaii were not interned was that we had a military governor named General Delos Emmons. And Emmons made a public statement right after Pearl Harbor. He said, we will not intern Japanese Americans, immigrant and American born, in Hawaii, because that's not the American way. We have a constitution to respect, and the constitution guarantees all of us equal protection of the law. And so Emmons behaved very differently than the commander of the West Coast, General John DeWitt, who said a Jap is a Jap is a Jap. In other words, these Japanese inherit loyalty to the emperor. There was a third reason why the Japanese in Hawaii were not interned. They constituted a formidable portion of the workforce. They were one-third of all factory workers. Not factory workers, but cane workers. So the plantations didn't want these Japanese or couldn't afford to have these Japanese interned and taken away from them. But also Pearl Harbor had a sizable Japanese-American workforce. And in order to rebuild Pearl Harbor, General Delos Emmons knew that he had to keep the Japanese workers there in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor.
Well, in comparing Pearl Harbor and 9/11, what do you think government actions like Executive Order 9066 and special registration or deportation, what do those kinds of responses say about America's acceptance of non-white immigrants?
Well, with Pearl Harbor and 9/11, the victims, the Japanese who were interned, and then the Muslim immigrants who are detained, were denied, have been denied their right to due process of the law. In the case of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese Americans were identified as the enemy because of their race. German Americans and Italian Americans were not interned on a mass basis. Many of them were detained, but you don't have like the total evacuation of the German and Italian populations. Of course, that would be logistically very difficult. But nevertheless, it happened to Japanese Americans because of their race. In the case of the detention of Muslims, they are being detained because of their nationality. But still, their nationality means that they also have a different complexion, too. And so, you know, it's difficult to make a distinction between nationality and race. In the case of Muslims, however, there's no consideration by the government to detain all Muslims, because you're maybe talking about 6 million of them. But nevertheless, you do have like thousands of Muslims who have been detained and are still in prison and have not been charged with a crime. You also have or had, after Pearl Harbor, hate crimes. Japanese Americans were attacked, they were beaten up, their homes were burned. And after 9/11, you also have the explosion of hate crimes. In Arizona, a Sikh who was wearing a turban and who was the owner of a gasoline station was shot to death by an American who said, I'm a patriot all the way. So there are parallels between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. I wish that we would remember what happened in Hawaii, where we had a military governor who remembered that this is America and that America has a constitution to respect and to enforce the way we treat our citizens and non-citizens in the United States of America.
Well, I mean, that's a very unique perspective under wartime conditions, it seems.
Yeah, but that's the perspective we need, because why are we going to war? It's to protect this nation and what this nation stands for. And this nation stands for the Declaration of Independence, which acknowledges that equality is a self-evident truth, and it stands for the Constitution.
You've talked about acceptance of America as being, or not acceptance, but just this ideal of America being white, you know, particularly with paternalism, that America is white and the workers are brown. What do you think these kinds of race-based actions reflect?
Oh, they reflect what can be called the master narrative of American history. It's the powerful, pervasive, but mistaken story that this country was settled by European immigrants and that Americans are white or European in ancestry. Where does this master narrative come from? It comes from our history books, but it also comes from our media. Just recently, PBS aired a program on the makers of America, and almost all of the makers of America, about 95% of them, were white men. Charles Crocker was featured in this miniseries, but not the Chinese workers who built that transcontinental railroad and were exploited by Charles Crocker. So there is this master narrative being presented by our textbooks and by the media, but also by our political leaders. Take, for example, President Bush. He said that this war against terrorism is a crusade. Well, right there, crusade, what does that mean? It means white and European Christian. And of course, Bush did backtrack and did apologize to the Muslim community. But nevertheless, the word was already out there. But it gets hidden also in other languages of the Bush administration. When he says, hunt them down, smoke them out, wanted dead or alive, this is the language of the frontier. And what was the frontier? The frontier was conquest over native peoples of this continent.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other kinds of observations about comparisons or differences between post 9/11 and post Pearl Harbor reactions in America or government responses? What do you think it says about how we view immigrants?
I can give a complicated answer. Okay. When you think about Pearl Harbor, you think that the United States was attacked by Japan. But the fact is this, before Pearl Harbor, Japan and the United States were trying to avoid war with each other. Japan did not want to enter a war against a super economy and a super military. The United States did not want to enter into a war against Japan because it was focused on the Nazi threat in Europe. And so Roosevelt said, look, we don't want a war with Japan. In fact, his military said, we can't fight a two-ocean war, a war in the Atlantic and a war in the Pacific. So Roosevelt was trying to avoid confronting Japan militarily. Japan also wanted to avoid a war with the United States because it was importing 80% of its oil from the United States. It needed American oil to fuel its war machinery in China. Roosevelt sent Japan warnings to stay out of French Indochina and the Dutch East Indies. He was protecting the Dutch Empire and the French Empire in Asia, and also the British Empire in Singapore, in Malaysia. And so in order to put some pressure on Japan, he issued an embargo of oil against Japan. That embargo, however, had loopholes in it. American companies could reapply for licenses to ship oil to Japan so long as it did not ship aviation oil. The Commerce Administration misread the embargo and thought it was a total embargo. It did not see that loophole, and so it imposed an embargo of oil, all oil, against Japan. And so Japan, the Japanese military, thought, well, we need another source of oil. And so they decided to strike southward toward the Dutch East Indies, where there were oil fields. And that led them into conflict with the United States, because the United States had was a power in Asia. The Philippines was an Asian colony. Okay, and that forced Japan then to attack Pearl Harbor. So when you look at Pearl Harbor, what you have there is a site for the clashing of empires, the Dutch, British, French, and U.S. empires in Asia. Now, with 9/11, you also have a clashing of empires here too. What's 9/11 all about? It's about oil, okay? And the American empire in the oil-producing regions of the world. And where are these oil-producing regions located? They're located largely in Muslim nations, okay? So when you think of 9/11, you can think about the empire of oil. And when you think about December 7th, you can think about the empires colliding in the Pacific. But how many historians, or how many newspapers, or how many editors, or how many newscasters would point this out? None of them, as far as I can see.
Wow. Yeah.
Makes you think, huh, about empires, yes. Hawaii was part of the empire, too. Cane production. When did it start? It started in 1832 when an American, a white American named William Hooper, went to Hawaii. And he was there working for a company. And the company assigned him to go to Kauai to develop sugar production. And so he cultivated 25 acres of cane and began to export cane, sugar. Where? To the United States. Hawaii at that time was an independent nation. And Hooper described his first plantation as the entering wedge of America. That this first plantation then would open then the way to the development of agriculture, U.S.-dominated agriculture in Hawaii. And indeed, that's what happened, because that led to the Great Mahele of 1846, where the Hawaiian sovereignties were persuaded to privatize lands in Hawaii. And those lands then were purchased and were granted to these missionary families. And these missionary families then used these lands to develop sugar production. So Hawaii became part of an American economic empire, you see. You talk about globalization today. Well, already Hawaii was part of the American global economy. Investments were made by Americans in Hawaii, and sugar was produced in Hawaii and then shipped to California. CNH, where do you get CNH? It's California and Hawaii, okay? The raw sugar was transported to the refineries right here in California and then crystallized into sugar. So when you think about Hawaii, you think about empire. Yeah.
And from that early point on, can you talk about the U.S. interest in Pearl Harbor?
U.S. interest in Pearl Harbor. You're talking about the military base itself. That came with annexation, you know, that the United States Navy would be guaranteed ownership of this harbor, this natural harbor, and that became a primary naval base for the United States. The United States needed Hawaii as a naval base. Why? Because it also needed Manila as a naval base. And the roots of this go back to the late 19th century when sailing vessels were converted from sail-driven energy to steam-driven energy. So you have the introduction of steamboats in the 19th century. And where does steam get its power? It gets its power from coal, okay? So these ships, the new Navy of the late 19th century, needed coaling stations in order to have power in Asia. And this led then the United States to have a war against Spain, 1898, the Spanish-American War. And this war against Spain had a hidden agenda. It was to conquer the Philippines, which was a Spanish colony, so that we could have a harbor, a coaling station in the Philippines. Hawaii also became important strategically as a coaling station, and that's why Pearl Harbor had to become part of the United States Navy.